Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, GeForce GTX 760. If you've got $250, this GPU is full of wind. Alan's here with SSD deals, NAS drive recommendations, red drives explained, and we talk about Haswell. So many updates and so many viewer questions. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 223, recorded June 27th, 2013. NVIDIA GeForce GTX 760 is full of wind. This episode of Twitch is brought to you by Manpax. Manly goods on a schedule. Get started today and have underwear, socks, toiletries, shaving supplies, and more delivered right to your door. Visit Manpax.com/twit and get $10 off your first order of $30 or more, or buy a $50 gift card for $40. Once again, that's Manpax.com/twit. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, important, and helpful news from the PC hardware front. We love to talk about tablets. We love upgrading, getting the fastest performance, gaming, storage, and well, if it's PC, we likes it. If it's tablets, we probably like it. If it's phones, we talk about it if we need to. Be a good episode for storage this week. Alan Malventano joining us from PCPer.com. How are you, sir?
Howdy.
Were you rallying, sir?
I might have been.
Because you would never street race in your beautiful GTI. That could only be a safety rally. Or is that a track? And it just looks like the great outdoors.
No, it was organized. It was an organized rally. Around nice 110 miles of nice twisty canyon roads in Texas.
Oh, sweet. Was it glorious?
Yes. But my girlfriend was actually getting like a little nauseous, and she usually loves this sort of thing. Right. And she's like, we're like halfway through, and she's like, I'm feeling a little, you know. And I'm like, well, we've been on a roller coaster for about, you know, 45 minutes now. But the cooler picture is the second one, actually.
Ooh.
If you look at that, Burke, that was just a few months ago. The other picture is, there's another. No, not that. You got to go back to the docky thingy and the that's not it.
You like your car a lot, Alan.
The left and down one, down left side.
Did you completely rebuild your engine?
That one, yes. Look, that's a nice picture. Not that one. It's nope. Burke, is it? Look at all the little thingies, all disassembled.
Structure.
Yeah,
that's
that one.
An engine. It's like, people,
it's like I fix it for your car. That's basically what I did.
This. Did you basically rebuild it from you completely rebuilt it?
Yeah. Just
did
little.
You have it balanced sort of and blueprinted, yo?
Well, so here's what happened. That started with an oil change. And,
I swear, came out with the oil.
The guys at work were really like jabbing me about it. They're like, that's a really expensive oil change you got going there, Al. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, sorry.
So I got to ask, do you have sort of, do you have a dyno run that gives you an idea of what the performance after the rebuild is? Or was it just a pure sort of standard rebuild? Or did you get a little nutty and have it balanced and maybe port the heads? And
I did I did many upgrades.
All legal.
It's a 2 liter. It's a 2 liter four cylinder. It gets 30 miles to the gallon and it's pushing close to 400 horse.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
It's fun. It's very fun.
Gas or diesel?
Gas.
I'm just
trying. I know you're the TDI guy. I know.
I have my issues. I'm the Cummins diesel guy. Wait till you see the dyno on my truck in a few weeks. It'll be obscene.
This week in car hardware.
Oh my goodness. We should probably talk about, while we're talking about hardware, people are here for computer hardware. Samsung 840 is still the SSD to beat. So it's still your favorite sort of, you know. This is, if you're not looking for the ultimate in SSD speed, this is kind of your favorite as the...
Actually, first of all, where'd that question come from?
That was for me, dude.
Oh, just in general? Yeah, 840 Pro. I usually toggle between 840 Pro and 840. 840, if you want more of a power user kind of thing and you can find a deal on it, go 840 Pro. If you're more of a consumerish sort of a person, the 840, everything on reads is still almost identical.
Uh-huh.
It's just the writes that are, it has to hold back a little bit because it's triple L cell flash. So that's sort of the catch. But yeah, I mean, they're, you know, if you can find them on a deal, they're good. And the most recent OCZ drive that I reviewed, which also had a number, which confuses me because they changed it.
Mercedes, BMW. It was the 760 or the M12.
it's almost that bad. No, Vertex 450.
Okay.
That's the one where they used their IndieLynx controller and put it on 20 nanometer MLC flash. And it just performed really well because the IndieLynx controller has sort of come a long way. And the idea behind that is if the bang for the buck is supposed to be phenomenal, provided that the stores can keep them on the shelves at the price that OCZ wanted to sell them for. So, you know, it was like, you know, right around $1 a gig or less for an MLC drive, not a TLC drive. So
that's pretty,
you know, it's sort of a toss up basically between that and the Samsung's, you know, it's either way.
So basically you're just buying SSD at this point. If it's OCZ, Samsung or Intel, you're good.
And as we'll talk about in a little while, maybe even an Intel Enterprise SSD, believe it or not, but
really?
We'll get there.
Yeah, it was funny because it was a couple weeks ago, they have like the Samsung 840, 500 gigabyte was selling for like $250 on a sale. And I was just like, do you think we're within a year of like a $250, sub $250, 1 terabyte SSD? Or is that sort of a little bit farther out, 18 months, 2 years, forever?
I think more like 2 years for that, because that's kind of steep, right? That's like 25 cents a gig.
Okay.
That would be nice. I'd really like that. That'd be, you
I'd
know,
take two.
I probably would. I just don't think we're going to get there within a year's time. I think it's going to be a little more than that. Because it's. I don't want to say it's been tapering out, but we've been talking about $1 a gig for an awful long time. And it keeps bouncing on either side of that. You know, it's generally you're only less than that on sales as opposed to these drive. You know, Drive X has always been selling for less than $1 a gig. Like, you haven't really seen that yet. So, yeah.
We can dream. Intel not releasing. We're always dreaming. Or at least aspirational computing, like to think of it. All I want is just one of Ryan's graphics cards that's laying around. Intel not releasing 14 nanometer Broadwell CPUs next year. Haswell and Haswell E will dominate 2014. Tim Berry wrote this up for PC Perspective. Quote, alongside the good news of 8-core Haswell eParts VR Zone revealed in an updated Intel roadmap that makes no mention of the 14-nanometer Haswell architecture die shrink Broadwell. So Broadwell is supposed to be the tick in the TikTok release. And the general rumor, consensus, ear to the ground opinion is that Intel is having issues with the 14-nanometer process. But it's kind of funny because that's the big difference between Broadwell and Haswell is the die shrink from 22 nanometer to 14 nanometer. Was Tim talking about this on the PC Per podcast last night?
Tim's not usually on the podcast, but everybody else sort of dives in on his pieces and we just talk about it. But yeah, it's just gonna take him a little longer. Really, getting the 22 nanometers kind of a jump. I mean, come on, That's the
30% reduction
itself.
In die size. 30% reduction in process, leading to a reduction in die size. Well, it's crazy. I mean, first of all, and the fact that they don't really need to rush this because they can look in the rear view mirror and then they stop the car and climb a tree and look over the horizon and they see AMD in terms of performance. I'll get email from that statement.
But, you probably will.
probably justified. But AMD's not that far behind. But it's kind of like, in terms of process, Intel's so far ahead of anybody else in just about any industry.
Right. They really do have it down. I've walked through one of their fabs a couple of years back, and it's pretty amazing.
So Tim writes, with the launch of Broadwell moved back to at least 2015, consumers will now be presented with a refresh of 22 nanometer Haswell chips on the consumer side around the second quarter of 2014 and the enthusiast platform Haswell E processors in the second half of 2014. It's basically a new chipset, Z97 chipset. Are you annoyed with another chipset jump next year, or are you looking forward to upgrading your motherboard annually at this stage of life?
So the PC Perspective Storage Testbed has had probably, I think I'm on three iterations since Mm-hmm. I did my most recent upgrade to my main rig, which is still on a X58.
Right.
It's, you know, it's just like, yeah, that works. I just leave it over there. And yeah, but I might actually make the jump to Haswell, which actually brings up an interesting point in that Intel segregation. We have a backroom chat on PCPer, and we were sort of complaining or griping about this, if you will, last night. Haswell introduced some extra new nifty stuff. I don't know if you've read on it, as the transactional memory extensions.
Mm-hmm. I can't explain it, but I've read about it.
It's basically just extra extensions to handle more fine-grained locking of blocks of memory. So you have a multi-process CPU that can handle multiple threads all at the same time, and those threads might want to share similar blocks of memory. And in the past, meaning everything prior to Haswell, those blocks are relatively big, right? So you can't have so much, you know, it's not very fine-grained, and it's not very software-controlled either. So you can't really write a program that says, okay, I want these five threads to all share this one very small chunk of memory. It's just not possible. The instruction set doesn't support it. So Haswell added that, and I sort of see like some good consumer side applications of this, like some applications being compiled for this, and maybe just making, you know, multiple process kind of apps go faster, just in general, right? I sort of got bit in the butt because I ordered one of the Haswell chips that I thought only didn't have the VXD extensions, which is the hardware extensions for VMware, which previously, you know, that's not such a big deal because there's a different set of instructions, VMware instructions that are supported anyway. So you're pretty much, if you're just running regular old VMware, you're covered. Well, the same deal goes for these transactional memory extensions. So if you order a Haswell chip that does not have the VXD stuff and you're like, I don't run a VMware ESX server, whatever cluster, I don't care about that. It doesn't have the transactional memory stuff either. So
you bought one of the overclockable chips.
Yes. And I sort of see this tech as being something that would probably filter down into people doing stuff at home with, but I don't know. Maybe not yet.
Ryan and I were talking last week about how peculiar the sort of, you know, siloing of the overclocking versus all the really cool advanced features on the chipset. It was kind of strange to look at that story and be like,
I know. You'd figure it's like, I want the Mac Daddy to have everything.
I think they're afraid of Google to start overclocking their consumer grade hardware in their servers. It's a thin theory, but it's mine. Lenovo announcing new Haswell powered Windows 8 devices. Not the Lenovo S210, not the Lenovo S400, not the Lenovo S500, but the U330 Touch and the U430 Touch, which causes me some emotional trauma because I like the idea of cheap laptops with Haswell inside, because I am, generally speaking, a inexpensive laptop buyer. I also got to say, the more time I spend with touchscreen, I got a Lenovo touchscreen desktop that I love, but I almost never use the touchscreen. And with laptops, it's even more difficult for me to adjust to the idea of reaching out with Windows 8 and touching the screen. Some beautiful looking laptops, though. Lenovo's got some really nice design work going on, at least if you like the sort of MacBook Air aesthetic. HP has released the HP Envy 17TJ000. $750 was the deal that was posted on PC Per. Haswell Core i7-4700MQ at 2.3 gigahertz, 8 gigabytes of DDR3, a 1 terabyte hard drive, and Blu-ray, and a 16:900 display that you can upgrade for a little bit more money to a 1080p display. And a GeForce GT740M for a whopping $830. So if you're willing to go the HP route, I just like the idea of getting all of that battery life for well under $1,000. That kind of gets me excited.
Yeah, they're finally starting to come down. And I too probably would never use the touchscreen on a device like that. But I will say there's a little hidden bonus, even if you never use the touchscreen, is that they had to engineer the glass on the front of the touchscreen to handle touching. Right? So, so unlike previous laptops, you don't have to like cringe and use only ultra soft cotton to clean your screen anymore, right? It's designed to get a little bit of punishment there, so you don't have to worry so much about scratching it by looking at it funny.
Super easy to wipe peanut butter off too. I still just wish they would do. It's amazing. I was watching. We were trying to decide if the Toshiba Kira with Core i7, which is fantastic, fast notebook, sure, laptop. I've got the Windows 8.1 update on it. Yay! Booting straight to the desktop. But it's been funny. We're having the argument about how grease resistant the touchscreen was, which can be really, really horrible if you have a room full of geeks trying to figure out how to the fastest way to get grease on the screen and somebody immediately starts wiping their nose and touching your laptop. But the more I have touchscreens in Windows 8, the less I use them. Which is kind of strange and peculiar. Also strange and peculiar, it looks like Haswell power management is super, super critical to Haswell battery life, or that big like 40-50% battery life we've been seeing, improvement we've been seeing in benchmarks. Ken wrote this up for PC Per. MacBook Air 11-inch 2013 review from a Windows perspective, and it's kind of crazy that I think the big story on that one was just looking at the battery life, which goes from, and I apologize if we talked about this with Ryan last week, but it's crazy. It's basically using boot camp, running Windows on the MacBook Air with the Haswell CPU. Battery life system is like 699 minutes with OS 10 and 315 minutes with Windows. That is a huge drop.
Yeah, we're thinking that they just didn't support some form of something, you know, just that. Now Ken was saying that this uses they incorporate the standard Haswell whatever chipset driver. Mm-hmm. So I think it might just be something, maybe we suggested last night for him to try Windows 8.1, because maybe it's something that just needs to be supported more in the kernel for it to be telling the CPU to use, you know, whatever these states may be, even though you already have the driver installed. We're not sure, we're only speculating at this point, but it seems weird that you have that device, which has very similar hardware to all of the other devices, which are claiming, like all the Windows only ones that come out are claiming almost twice the battery life, right?
Interesting.
And most of them are actually getting almost twice the battery life, like more similar to what that MacBook Air is getting when running OS 10. So it's weird.
It is weird. Also weird, at least to me, because we've been sort of ignoring memory speeds for a while because they don't seem to have much of a detectable performance boost. When you look at the benchmarks, it's like, oh, I'm going to get to super fast RAM. Don't bother. Jeremy wrote this up. I guess it was Mad Shrimps tested Corsair's Vengeance Pro. So it's a 16 gigabyte 2400 C10 memory kit. A pair of 8 gigabyte DIMMs with timings of 10, 12, 12, 31 at stock, and part of the family of RAM that runs from 8 gigabytes to 32 gigabytes and is available in, brace yourself, speeds up to 2,933 megahertz. Would you believe not the most overclocking friendly RAM running at that speed?
Yeah, that's a lot of address lines to be slinging back and forth there at really high speeds, you know.
But yeah, it's funny. I'm kind of curious to watch some of the benchmarks as we look at this to see whether or not memory, because for a while there, it's like, you know, you'd play with memory, you'd tweak memory, you'd overclock memory, you go to faster memory, you'd be looking at it and being like, hey, I got a performance boost. But for a while, especially on an Ivy Bridge, not really seeing a lot of love on that one. And looking at the Mad Shrimp's benchmarks, I'm not really seeing a huge difference here. Well, I take that back, actually. Bandwidth, there's a huge difference.
Wow. Yeah, that's where you get the big difference.
Okay.
It's more like a drag car, right?
Right.
It's fast in a straight line. Not very nimble.
Doesn't turn for crap. Yeah, that's actually basically crazy, especially when you're looking at multiple cores. Wow. Yeah, Cinebench R10 64-bit. Oh, no, that's flatlined again. Interesting. Wow, you aren't kidding. It does not turn well, but it does go great in a straight line.
Yes, that's pretty much what it is.
Yeah, 3D Mark 06, no difference between the 2400 megahertz memory and the 1600 megahertz memory. 3D Mark 11, slightly faster, maybe 10% faster in terms of the 3D Mark score. Mafia 2 and Crysis 2, dead even. Gaming will not be improved by your high-speed RAM, kids.
Yep.
It has its place.
Yeah, it all depends on what you're using it for.
Well, it's true. But for everyday computing tasks, your 2400 hertz memory is only going to be useful for bragging rights. So it is what it is. NVIDIA GeForce GTX 760 2GB review GK104 at $250. I want this card really bad.
Yeah, super, super good bang for the buck. Josh cannot rave about that guy enough.
Replaces the 660 Ti in NVIDIA's lineup, 1152 CUDA cores running at a base clock of 980 megahertz and a typical boost clock of 1033 megahertz. Basically the same 6 gigahertz, 256-bit memory bus, 2 gigabyte and 4 gigabyte frame buffer options. 1152 CUDA cores broken over 6 SMX units. That means you'll be seeing some parts with 3 GPCs and others with 4. NVIDIA claims any performance delta between them will be negligible. $249 price point. That's awesome, actually.
Yep, that's the key right there. $250.
And
half
probably
the price of what I spent on a GTX 680 not too long ago.
and a good $50 less than AMD's competing card. Got a AMD must be like looking at the 79. So basically the GTX 760 is outperforming the 7950 boost that costs $50 more than the GTX 760.
Yes.
This is awesome.
That's making AMD has their calculators out.
AMD and they're figuring out. Are there any particular benchmarks? Oops, sorry.
What?
Oh, I was going to say, are there any particular benchmarks where it really stood out?
It was just across the board. It was pretty, I don't think there was any like super wow in this one thing. It's amazing. no, but just in general, it just continued to sort of walk on the competition. So it's bad for the competition, especially since it's a cheaper card.
I'm ready to upgrade my GPU now just as soon as I sell something. Oh my goodness. And if you're into that kind of thing, the Zotac GTX 760 Amp Edition is the fastest clock GTX 760 so far. So if you need to have the fastest GTX 760 on the block, not that anybody else on the block has one yet, they managed to overclock it to 1111 megahertz base, 1176 megahertz boost. And I dare say that you will not be able to detect any performance difference between that and the standard GTX 760. Just saying. And that was a quick write-up by Tim Berry from Zotac's press release. Zotac, by the way, I really, really, really like their mini ITX Haswell motherboard. That would be really, really cool for a home theater PC. Just saying. Moving over to the storage side of things, Mr. Maventano, shingled hard drives, not just the adult resurgence of a childhood disease or roofing materials, just to lay down all of the puns early on, shingling hard drives.
It's actually closer to roofing than you might think.
Layers of hard
Believe
drives.
It or not.
Okay.
Sort Zoom of. It. Okay. so here's the deal. While you have solid state storage is sort of replacing what used to be hard drives for random access. And that means that hard drives are now sort of replacing tape for what used to be backup. Okay. So which means that you might have applications for a hard drive where you want the absolute most storage for the buck possible is what you're looking for, more so than random access capability.
Okay.
So if you were to remove that the ability to write randomly to a hard drive and make it more like a throwback from, say, the CDRW days, right, where you know you could write to it, and then you could write maybe a little bit more and a little bit more. But then once it was full, you had to sort of start over from the beginning.
A tape drive.
Sort of. Right? It sort of works like a tape drive, right? That's right. Sort of how CDRW-ish works way back when, right? Remember, you had to wipe out the whole disk once it was full, right? You couldn't just randomly write to it. You can do the same sort of a thing on a hard drive, and you can double the capacity. Or better.
Why and the idea, can you double the capacity?
That's
a good reason to writing sequentially on a drive to double its capacity. That is a great reason to eliminate sequential writes.
Or you mean
wow? Well, okay. So how does... Go ahead. Sorry.
How does it work?
Yeah.
Okay. all right. So here's the thing. The way current hard drive technology is right now, you can read from the drive with much greater focus than you can write to it.
Okay.
So when you write to it, they're just basically limited based on the technology. The track has to be so wide. They can't go any narrower based on what we can make for a write head. Okay. However, we can read much more fine-grained than that. So the read head can be because it's just reading. It's just sensing. As opposed to the write head, which is actually trying to change magnetic, domains on a disk, right?
Sure.
So it's more of a blunt thing compared to the reading, which is more of a delicate thing. So if you were to do, if you were writing the disk and say, just picture like a record. Okay, so you have the record, the arms going across the record. And that's actually the same way the arm sweeps on a hard drive, because it actually goes out to in, like from the outer edge of the disk to the inner part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you imagine if your writing had to be so wide. Well, what if you wrote one track and then you only moved a half of the width of what you were writing?
Oh, wow.
Okay, so you overwrote half of what was just there, but the other half is still there, right?
Right.
And then you keep doing that over and over and over again. So you just sort of deal with the fact that, okay, look, I'm going to overwrite half of what I just wrote, but the other half's still going to be there. Okay, fine. And then you just write the whole disk that way. As long as you understood that that's what took place, then when you go to read, you only read from the outer half of each track.
What?
Sorry, what? I didn't realize my mic was on.
That's okay.
Back up a second and start.
We just got, no, wait, it's I know. Just, that's okay. It's just Burke. Chad. Burke's the man. He can pipe in whenever he wants. Anyway, Burke was so excited. Chad. Listen, he loves this technology. He was
Chad,
so excited.
Come here.
He's like, no, it's actually not that at all.
It's like, you've got to hear
was
about
stuck.
These,
okay.
These tracks.
There's just, if you hit the fade to black button on the TriCaster, it completely locks up.
It
unless...
destroys everything. It's the worst.
On a very special episode of Twitch, Burke destroys everything.
And it's not intuitive at all.
Dude, you guys totally got to leave that in. Seriously, this is awesome.
Like, the way to get out of it is like so unnormal. You're just like, what?
So,
well,
Burke,
that's because we've all been trained. Chat,
Burke and OMG Chat are doing Tai Chi right now. They're like doing some kind of
you're right in the middle of like a very complex explanation.
Yes.
First, you've got to burn incense so that the TriCaster feels
first,
comfortable.
First, don't leave your mic on. Okay, so I'm sorry.
So, do we got to roll back or are we just good? We'll just go.
I don't know.
Okay, I'm just going to go.
Let's keep it in.
All right. Yeah, keep
muting
it in.
My mic.
So basically, since you've written and overwritten over and over again, like only parts of the previous track, as long as you go front to back and you don't try to stick something back in the middle, because then you'll overwrite. Both halves of something, right?
Oh, crazy. Right.
Yeah, that would be bad, right? You can't just put stuff back in the middle once you've done that. You have to go front to back and start over, basically.
That's crazy.
You can get twice the density, right? So the only sort of complexities to this technology is you have to somehow... you can either make the drive smart enough to somehow handle if you did happen to write randomly to it, uh-huh. which would probably be really complicated and... almost impossible to pull off. And then the other method is where the operating system or the kernel or something on the system side would have to be aware of, hey, you can only write to this hard drive front to back, dude. You just can't, don't just go sticking something in the middle. If you try, I'm just not going to let you, that sort of thing. So maybe more like the hard drive equivalent of like tape backup interface software, basically.
Do you think this is going to show up for like consumer, maybe NAS boxes? Or is this, because it's crazy, like Western Digital, Seagate, Toshiba, and Hitachi are all working on the next step in increasing the storage density of platter-based drives. Are they all working on similar technologies? Are they working together to create a spec for enterprise? Is this enterprise only? Is this something that can show up in the consumer space?
I'm thinking it's more the latter. I think they're just sort of getting together and going, look, we want to do this. Everybody sort of agrees we want to be able to pull this off. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a common thing. We can't have like each, imagine if you had every single tape drive manufacturer all completely, well, that's actually sort of how it is. So they're sort of already completely different, right? And that's just a Greek tragedy if you try to compare that. You can't take a tape backup from one system and just like slap it in another one. It just doesn't work, right? So these guys, the interface is a standard, so they probably want to keep it, you know, this is just speculation, right? They probably want to get together and sort of keep it a standard. But I do believe that all of that work is only for enterprise-y kind of stuff. Okay. I'm fairly certain that that's all they're going for. I mean, like, this is our enterprise, sequential backup drive or, you know, whatever they want to call it, right? And then that'll just be, you know, you get, instead of 4 terabytes for this guy, you know, you get 8 terabytes. And the platters are basically the exact same thing. All it is like a different firmware and maybe a couple of tweaks to how the head works.
Got the drive. Because it's funny because the write-up on the register on this kind of mixes Hammer and Shingling. And Hammer, which is heat-assisted magnetic recording, is a completely separate technology from this, although the Shingling technology could be used on heat-assisted magnetic recording.
It could, but it's a completely I don't think that's there yet. Okay. I think this has a chance, even though they have all those hurdles to jump over as far as interface and how you write to it and whatever. I think this has a better legs on it than the Hammer stuff, because the Hammer stuff takes a lot. I mean, you have to have like a laser on the head, and it has to point at the same stuff that you're about to write to, and that's just... Right.
It's essentially heating the magnetic material to enable you to write smaller bit signifiers on it.
That's it.
Okay. Hammer.
Yeah, when it's warm, you can do more fine-grained writing.
Because the molecules are bigger, which is kind of insane to realize just how insane magnetic recording technology has gotten. Is that something that everybody's working on, or is that primarily a Western Digital technology?
For the Hammer stuff? I think it didn't start out as Western Digital saying that. As a matter of fact, I don't even think Western Digital is really pushing it. I think it was a Hitachi thing. Initially, and this was about a year ago when they started talking about that. Yeah. It's either Toshiba or Hitachi. It's one of the other guys.
But, I was just looking at
here's the thing. I don't see them doing both at the same time. I know the register was all over that, and just because you see one technology that's like, ooh, this could increase capacity. Oh, by the way, here's this other one that could also, right? You don't want to make it super complicated all at the same time, right? You're already overlapping tracks. You're probably going to stick with the thing that you already know everything about, right? You're not going to just throw in some new variable at the same time.
While we're overriding and heating and cooling and moving at high speed, any idea of when the shingled data storage technology might start showing up, or when can CTOs kind of start planning on replacing their tape systems? While leaking they have from the rooftops with happiness?
They have to make a new spec.
Got it.
That those things usually, they're usually like a year or two. Like, even though I bet you that there's probably something like one of these drives in a lab somewhere right now that can do overlapping tracks.
Right.
It's probably, you know, they probably just did some tweaks and they're like, look, hey, this works. 8 terabytes. You know, whoop-de-doo. And now there's like a bunch of other dudes with, you know, lab coats and calculators, and they're all trying to write up like, oh my goodness, how are we going to make this, you know, work?
I was going to say, this is when they start paying to have consultants attend the IEEE meetings so they can battle over the intricacies of the spec and try to give their patent base an advantage over the other one's patent.
And that takes time, unfortunately.
Time that we don't have. So you mentioned earlier that Intel's enterprise drives might be an option for consumers as we're looking at the 840 and the new OCZ drives and the Samsung drives, the OCZ drives, Intel's consumer drives. You mentioned Intel's enterprise SSDs might be an option for the consumer, and you just did a large roundup, to say the least. X25E, SSD 320, 710, 910, DCS 3500, and S3700 compared. Yes. I am willing to say that this is the largest Intel enterprise drive roundup ever attempted.
I included every Intel enterprise drive ever made.
That would do it.
So that's one way to check the box, I guess. It's just like, hey, look, I have one of all of them. I'll take one of everything. And there. And so I just made a review around it.
It's so funny because this actually goes back to the X25E. So this is...
Yes.
What did you find out? They all ran the same, and the higher price stuff isn't worth it, right? We should all buy drives from three generations ago?
Okay. No.
Damn.
Well, sort of. I don't know. All right. So Intel, as far as the enterprise stuff, it's sort of a weird and torturous path. Okay, so they had their initial X25-ish, like, I'll say E, but their 10-channel controller. That initial SSD they came out with, X25M, that controller, that thing, they hung on to that controller forever. It was the same controller that was in the SSD 320 series and the SSD 710 series. They just, like, would not let go of that thing. Mainly because they weren't ready with their own 6-gigabit controller, unfortunately. So on the consumer side, they sort of borrowed some other people's stuff to release consumer 6-gigabit drives because everybody was breathing down their neck. They're like, hey, we want, everybody else is making a 6-gigabit serial ATA. Why are you not? What's wrong with you guys? And so they had like the 510 that had a Marvell controller that had Intel firmware on it. And then they had the 520 that had a SandForce controller that had Intel firmware on it. So Intel's like insistent, they're like, we're going to do our own firmware, we're going to make it better. But at the same time, it was still other people's controllers. Right. So it's sort of, you know, embarrassing, I would say, for and it's Intel, right? These are the guys that made this super awesome SSD that walked all over everything else at the time when it came out. And what's wrong with you guys? So they came out with the 910 series as a stopgap on the enterprise side, primarily, and that was a PCI Express SSD. But again, they had to borrow other people's stuff. So that was an LSI RAID card, basically, except they took the RAID part out. So all it ended up giving you was 4 200-gig Hitachi SAS SSDs behind an LSI controller, which was really, again, convoluted and complicated. And it was almost like it was looking for a problem to solve because... Because they were all segregated. Everything was 200-gig individual drives. You couldn't RAID them together in hardware. You had to go through all these, you know, you had to go through basically Windows software RAID to put them together into one drive, which was, I don't know, silly in my opinion. Well, more recently, end of last year and a couple weeks ago, they came out with a 6-gigabit controller of their own. It's only an 8-channel controller, but it's their own silicon, their own design. And it's a good controller. It's only coming out in the enterprise units for now because they still have other, SSDs to handle more of the consumer side anyway, for the moment. I don't think, you know, they're probably going to roll those out just so that they're using their own controller for everything moving forward. But for now we have the data center that they're abbreviated DCS, and the S is kind of complicated because it's not SLC.
Right.
It's high endurance MLC, like what's in most of their other enterprise stuff. So it's a DCS 3700, which came out last year, and 3500, which came out just a couple weeks ago. The 3700 was the first drive to come out, and it was 25-nanometer flash, which is the much more common flash that's been in almost everything. The reason they came out with the 3500 later is because it's using 20-nanometer flash. It's still MLC, but, you know, it's much cheaper to produce the 20-nanometer stuff. It's not rated for as long, but the performance is surprisingly on par with the 25-nanometer part of last year, which is good. Now, the kicker is that the S3500 is supposed to go for close to $1 a gig. This is an enterprise drive at $1 a gig. I think it's like $1.20. is what they're going for. I don't know if they're going to be able to sell them for this, but that's basically consumer. That's like Samsung 840 SSD pricing. So, and it's an enterprise unit.
I was looking over at your final thoughts, and you say, I realize some folks out there are going to knock the endurance ratings of the S3500, which works out to roughly 600 cycles, and that basically means writing to a particular chunk of memory 600 times, if I'm not mistaken, or overwriting. Given the capacities installed and usage seen in typical enterprise configurations, the S3500 is going to cover most of the bases. For the few configurations that are super heavy on writes, like the databases from hell, there's always the S3700. How does that compare to typical durability for a consumer SSD? Do we write more or less than an enterprise situation?
Well, Intel is marketing the 3500 series more towards clusters of virtual machines and less use than that. So not front-end database,
sure,
you know, the thing right behind the huge web server at Amazon, for example, or anything like that. More towards virtual machines, which are more, they tend to be more bulk storage-y sort of things. mm-hmm. right? Like most of it is stagnant data. Yes, some stuff is random access and random writes, but it's not horrible. You know, you're not writing huge amounts of bulk data into it, your virtual machine. It's usually right. just people trying to read their emails and do whatever on a virtualized system. So right. you just need, you want it to be fast storage, but you need a whole bunch of it. And you want right. it to be fast and mostly in the right stuff. So that's what this is tailored for. And I don't think, all right, so to give you sort of a generic comparison of the write cycle stuff, how it applies and uh-huh. how this compares, 25 nanometer flash memory is generally 3,000 cycles.
Got it.
So you take a drive, you can overwrite that entire drive worth of capacity, you know, 3,000 times. That's around when you're going to start burning out cells. The 25 nanometer stuff is generally rated for only 1,000 cycles.
Got it.
Okay, so this is slightly less than 1,000 cycles, most likely because it's optimized and designed to be able to handle, you know, yes, it's only 6,000 cycles, but that's like you're doing it at 4K random writes continuously. It's, you know, you're like the worst thing you could do to a solid state drive.
Right.
Absolute worst thing. And that's so when you put that into perspective, it's a pretty good rating, actually. Yeah. But here's the thing. At $1 a gig and the capacities that this thing is supposed to be available in, I mean, you know, the 3700 series, you can get 2.5-inch form factor, 800 gig.
Wow.
So
how much?
Well, that's up there because it's the 3700 series. So that's 25 nanometer flash that they packed a whole bunch into that drive. But the 20 nanometer stuff, you know, it's cheap, relatively.
comparatively and affordable.
It was just refreshing to see. I really hope that price holds out, and I hope that some of the e-tailers manage to try to get their hands on more of them to try to pet like Newegg and whatnot to try to pass them on to consumers, hopefully at anything close to that price, because any kind of a power user that usually goes for the absolute best kind of a drive and really knows they're going to beat up on their hardware, even though the wear rating is on the low side, this thing has, you know, power loss protection, has capacitance on board to back up power and make sure that things get flushed all the way out to the disk. If you did lose power in the middle of, you know, 25 simultaneous writes that a crazy storage guy, you know, might be doing, that sort of thing. I'd probably, you know, people like me would probably buy that to put into their home system for, you know, power user type stuff, especially at $1.20 a gig. It's almost a no-brainer.
It really is. Storage. I envy you the petabytes you play with at work, but we can't talk about that on a public show.
No.
We're going to talk about Windows 8.1 in a second. We've got some viewer questions. We got a little bit more news, but we got to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. It's brought to you by Manpax. Ladies and gentlemen, Manpax. Manly goods on a schedule. Get started today and have underwear, socks, toiletries, shaving supplies, and more delivered to your door. Manpax.com/twit is the place to go. If you have not heard about Manpax, I'm pretty sure Ryan and I have told you about them. It's the idea that you don't have time to shop for the basic sundries. Your t-shirts wear out. Your underwear looks like the dog's been sleeping on it. You ran out of razors again before the big trip. And suddenly you're running around at Walmart at 2 in the morning. I don't know if I can mention that, but it takes time to find good products. The idea of Manpax has thousands of men, some dedicated buyers, and they allow you to subscribe to your essentials. You can start them at any time. You can stop them at any time. But the idea is that every 3 months, you get a delivery. Manly goods on a schedule is what they call it. But if you wear out your socks, if you need more shaving cream, if you want a decent razor or a better razor, and you don't want to have to, you know, run into the big box store or the corner store, you can check out Manpax and check out the products they put together. The idea is that they vet the products. They certify the products. They call them Guy approved by Manpax. No duds or junk, just pure win. Shipping's free. Returns if you don't like the t-shirts or the socks or the underwear you buy. I was like, I'm stoked. They have my ex officio boxers on there. You know, you can manage your account on the website. It's pain-free, and you can start and stop at any time. Quote, we put customers first because we want customers for life. It is a noble goal, and I like it. I was actually really excited. Like I mentioned, like the boxers I like, ex officio boxers are available. I do not wear undershirts, but I believe Leo Laporte does, and he is a subscriber. I do not know if he subscribes for his undershirts. There they are, the beautiful give and go boxers, kids. You know, the idea of never having to wander into Costco to buy a gigantic pack of razors, exciting. I don't want to waste time running around. I want to have a magic box delivered to my door with the stuff I need to keep me looking good. And that's pretty much what Manpax is designed to deliver to the gentleman in your life. It's pretty cool. Manpax.com/twit is the place to go. And they have two exclusive offers for Twit listeners. $10 off your first order at $30 or more, or a $50 gift card for $40. And do us a favor, go to manpax.com and get started today. And we thank Manpax for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. It's good stuff, people. Check it out. You know, if some people, they do not like the retail experience, this is a way to get around it. Smooth and simple and delivered straight to your door. I like that. I like smooth and simple. It makes me happy. So we should take a moment. Let me slide up here. AMD is releasing the 8.1 version of Catalyst. And there's a really nice warning, actually. So Windows 8 release preview came out this week. Most people who are installing it right now, the Windows 8 installations, are doing it for the start button and the return of the boot to desktop that was eliminated in Windows 8. Basically, there's a Catalyst preview becoming available. And Scott wrote this up for PC Puri. It would be a good idea to refer to the AMD article to ensure that your specific model is supported. The driver covers many graphics cards and the Radeon APU. It was exciting. Burke, did you do that because they did something terribly wrong or because you were enjoying the fireball of doom from the Radeon, APU, and FirePro product categories? You know, it's kind of interesting. WDDM 1.3 using cross-adapter resources in a hybrid system. There's a whole bunch of stuff that they're playing around with Windows 8.1. But the big thing, the big warning there is that the Windows 8.1 release preview is essentially a dead end. Eventually, you'll have to reinstall all of your desktop software and all of your apps when the final code is released later this year. Scott calls it a detour to a dead end.
I will say this. I don't know what they did, but that thing installed within my VM front beginning to end, it couldn't have been longer than 5 minutes.
It was funny. It took us about an hour when we installed it. Actually, on the Kira, the Toshiba running right now, it took about an hour. But that was also literally like maybe within an hour of when they released Windows 8.1. So I think their servers were getting hammered. ISOs should be available today if you don't want to deal with downloading and installing.
That's what I installed from. It was the ISO.
Oh very cool.
Yeah, it's literally 5 minutes. It's like as fast as they can read it, and then it's just, okay, it's time to reboot, and here's Windows. Like,
wow. This is the man with the enterprise SSD storage in his home machine.
Well, that has a little something to do with it.
I'm just saying. While we're talking about AMD, AMD released AMD Radeon at AMD Radeon on Twitter released a tweet. Big news for Crossfire. We plan to release our driver that delivers improved multi-GPU frame rating on July 31st. More info soon. So if you've been following Ryan's saga of frame rating and generating sort of the next level or the next level of awesome in GPU testing. This is exciting news to hear that AMD is going to be delivering a driver upgrade that fixes that. And there's a nice article up at The Verge that's worth checking out by Sean Hollister. AMD won the next-gen console war and PC gamers could reap the reward with the idea that because developers aren't going to be spending so much time dealing with obscure and painful architectures on certain platforms or certain console platforms, they may be spending more time taking advantage of the fact that the consoles are essentially PCs and delivering you awesome gamey goodness. You know, because basically consoles aren't power PCs anymore, which is so cool. I'm actually kind of excited to see what comes out comes out of that. It was interesting. We got a couple good questions. It's kind of funny because there's so much news. There's like Haswell motherboards coming out. There's Samsung's ATIV or ATIV tablets, which are essentially running a virtual Android's machine inside of the tablet or laptop, which just kind of makes me bang my head, the idea that you're going to have sort of like a Windows i5-powered Android tablet. we should take advantage of Alan Malventano being here and get to those Twitter questions. At Canadian Geek tweets, at Malventano, if you had to choose between QNAP, Drobo, and Synology, which one would you choose and why? And the related question from Justin S. Black, who tweeted, I'm looking for a dedicated NAS enclosure, 4-bay QNAP, but wondering if the Drobo is worth all the hype or others.
Okay, so I'll just break them all down.
Okay.
How about that? All of the QNAP devices are more of a RAID card connected to X number of hard drives in a box.
Okay.
That's pretty much what it is. So, and with it carries all of the RAID card type of things. So when you create the array, it has to create the entire thing. It has to write to all of the drives front to back. It's a very flat sort of, this is the volume sort of thing. Which makes some things a little bit more of a pain in the butt. You know, they sort of want the hard drives to match in size, and it's, you know, it's the typical RAID, generic RAID sort of limitations.
Right.
And then they add some stuff on top of that. They have like some, basically there's apps that run within the back end that's driving this RAID card, and it does all sorts of server type things for your home, and, you know, sort of add some bells and whistles to it. But at its core, it's a RAID in a box, basically a generic RAID. Okay. I'll go to Synology next, because that's probably the easier, the next progression sort of.
Right.
Synology has sort of their own OS. I forget what they call it, but it's like their own little package deal. It's only like a few hundred meg, and then it sits on the device, and the device boots off of that, and it's just a dedicated OS just for being a NAS. So it has a bunch of extra little cool stuff. It does. It's a, you know, web-based configuration sort of thing. You know, those things are it's a good way to explain them. Well, they're sort of like, they're easy to just put anywhere. Like, for example, the IOSafe, I believe it's the N2, which was the RAID in a fireproof box, right? It uses the Synology, like its core hardware is the Synology product.
Oh, wow.
It's a disk station inside a fireproof box. It's pretty much it. All the way to the point where when you go to upgrade it, you don't get the software upgrade for it from IOSafe, who makes the entire unit. You just download the generic Synology software, and you just stick it right on that, and you have the most recent update. So that's very smart on IOSafe's part. They were just like, look, we don't want proprietary us anything other than the box, you know? So there's that sort of thing, and it gives you that gives you a little more flexibility in how the devices are partitioned and whatnot. It's less of a generic RAID and sort of an in between. It's, you know, that sort of thing. Now Drobo, throw all that out the window. Anything that has to do with a regular size RAID, because Drobo treats the whole thing as a logical chunk of storage, and it says, okay, I can put anything anywhere I want. I don't have to, like, quote-unquote, format the entire thing. You could basically have a Drobo and throw 24 terabytes worth of hard drive and hard drives in an 8-bit Drobo, and it'll take, like, 2 minutes to initialize.
Right.
Because it doesn't have to do anything. It's just like, okay, here's all the storage I have. I now know that I have all that storage. Here's a volume. You know. And then when you start to fill it, it just intelligently goes, okay, well, I want to make sure I have two or three copies of whatever, so right. I'm just going to put, you know, a chunk on these two drives and then a chunk on these two drives, and it just divvies it up as it pleases, and it has its own sort of deobfuscation sort of a table that it maintains as to what goes where and where, how do you look it up, sort of like how an SSD works, only you're spreading it over 8 hard drives instead of 8 flash chips, basically.
So it's kind of funny, because one of the things Drobo was like, we're not a RAID 5, we're not a traditional RAID, we're not a RAID at all, we're sort of, you know, a computer that manages, and they, you know, obviously Data Robotics was the initial, you know, Robo storage, we take care of it, don't worry about it if your drives die. There were some performance penalties in the early days of Drobo, those seem to have been eliminated. How are you feeling about it? If you were sort of like, I need storage, which direction would you be leaning?
So me personally, I mainly use Drobos as backup devices because I have a regular generic flat RAID card RAID in my own system, and that's where I put all my, you know, big stuff. And then if I need a backup, I just tend to use Drobos. But for my application, I could be using any one of those three, really, because I just need a volume to stick stuff on. That's really all I need. But I will say that for Drobos, the Drobos tend to be the thing that is much more graceful than the other two options when it comes to a drive, when a drive does fail.
Okay.
For example, if you had the Drobo only 10% full, on average, each one of the drives installed is going to be 10% full, assuming that they're all the same size, which, by the way, they don't all have to be the same size for a Drobo. You just throw whatever you have, and you fill the whole thing with whatever hard drives you have in the house, and it figures it out, right? It's like, okay, this is too small, and this is, all right, right. I'll put a little bit there, right? But when a drive does fail, and then you remove it, and you insert the new drive, and it does not have to rewrite the entire drive like a regular RAID does. It goes, well, right. I only need to put 300 meg worth of stuff to fill this void on this drive, and that's the only amount that gets copied. So the rebuild right. is proportional to how much stuff you have saved on it, not the size of the drives.
So basically, if you're looking at sort of the QNAP or Synology recovering from a dead drive, they could conceivably, as long as the drive's not completely full, they could take conceivably more time than the Drobo will to repair or replace a dead drive.
They could. And then the other thing that's a huge factor is, say you did only have that Drobo 10% full, mm-hmm. And one drive, you're on vacation for 2 weeks. One drive sure. fails the day you left, right? Mm-hmm. It assumes that drive's not going to come back the second that it fails. So mm-hmm. it goes, all right, well, let's say that this drive is not coming back. What do I have to do? Do I have enough room left right. to recreate the redundancy with all the drives that I have left installed? And it just does it.
Oh,
so
cool.
Basically, it would have already rebuilt. You could come back from vacation and there's one of the drives is red, indicating that it failed, and mm-hmm. everything has been restored redundancy-wise, so that another drive could fail that very minute that you walk in the door mm-hmm. and you did not lose everything where you normally right. would, right?
That's a big deal. Stuff. I mean, so you basically, you personally, you don't use Drobo for media serving or anything like that. It's primarily your deep storage, your long-term backup, or at least yes. your local long-term backup versus maybe the backup that's, you know, on a server somewhere else or on a commercial service in the cloud.
Well, okay, so my big backup is in my diehard old Drobo Pro 8 Bay. Mm-hmm. That is just basically a mirror of what's in my main system.
Got it.
And every so often, I manually sync that. It's not even automated. I fire it up, and then mm-hmm. it comes online, and then I just do a sync, basically. And I have an IOSafe N2 that can only hold 4 terabytes, but it's the thing that's going to store stuff when the house burns down. Right. So that's like,
hopefully
that's
it
like
doesn't.
Where, hopefully it doesn't, but if it did, right. then the stuff that's there is most likely still going to be there.
That would be good.
So that's sort of the, oh my God, I really need this stuff protected. And then the much, and then the, well, and 4 terabytes worth. And then right. the, that's like, you know, all, every single photo and video and whatever I've ever taken, basically. And then the stuff that's super vital to me that I can't necessarily have all of it backed up, like right here within, you know, 100 feet of me, that right. goes to Dropbox.
Got it.
Yep.
It's a good, notice people, layers, always layers.
Layers, yes. Do not have all eggs in one basket ever.
Two is one is none. And if both are inside of your house, you better hope you don't have a natural disaster. One more question before we go. Bill Fleming, a.k.a. at WD Fleming, tweets, I'm upgrading to 2 terabyte hard drives. Which online retailers package bare drives most securely, or should I buy a retail package? Pound no DOAs.
Yeah, I've been bitten by this too, and I don't know. Okay, here's how they come.
Okay.
When an online retailer buys them, okay, they come in boxes of 2 styrofoam rows. Patrick, mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen these.
Oh, I've seen them.
It's like a big box, right? And there's
a big old
egg crate
full of
it's like
drives.
It's sort of like an egg crate, and it holds, I think, 20, right?
Something like it's that. I've seen them anywhere 20. From 8 to 20, depending on
yeah.
what era and what manufacturer we're talking about.
Right. I know Western Digital ships them in boxes of 20.
Right.
Okay. Because I've built a server that had a whole crap load of them, and we bought a whole bunch of boxes of those. So that's how the online retailer gets them.
Mm-hmm.
So they just have to divvy it up somehow. So if you want non-retail packaging, you're going to deal with whatever they give you. So sometimes if you buy enough and they happen to have an egg crate style box that has that many slots in it, they might ship it to you in just one of those boxes.
Like, right.
here you go, and you might get good packaging. I've ordered, I think, 5 drives one time from a retailer, and they just stuck, you know, it was a box that was meant to hold 8, and they just stuck 5 in there, and they just, you know, sent it to me. But it's hit or miss, what you're going to get. You're just, and so the typical, go ahead.
Bubble wrap. I've seen bubble wrap. I've seen unsecured bubble wrap. I've heard rumors but never have seen loose packing with peanuts and or the big puffy air packages, which basically means the drive can settle to one side of the box.
I've never seen that. Okay.
I've heard it. Never seen it.
I typically order from Newegg. And yes, right. I do order hard drives, folks. I pay for them myself, too, on top of what I have floating around, because I'm crazy. So from Newegg, they typically come what seems to be very well wrapped in, like, securely wrapped bubble wrap surrounding. And if you buy five or six drives, then they sort of brick them together sometimes, which I don't like. But if you secure them together tightly enough, then you're not going to break anything.
Right.
It's sort of hit or miss. Newegg, you realize Newegg sort of has to eat some cost every time they ship a DOA drive and they back and forth and you try to return and everything. So I'd say they're one of the ones that's probably the most experienced at trying to not break them before they get to you. I can't speak to all the other people because I had a couple of bad experiences with some years and years ago and I just never bothered going back. Right. Yeah. But, and you know, of course you can always just do retail, but retail ends up being so much more expensive usually. You know,
it's we're lucky enough because I'm in California, we get sales tax charged on everybody now or from everybody. Everybody has a retail outlet or some sort of establishment here. So we get nabbed with the sales tax. It's been nice that like Central Computer, our local place is pretty good or pretty competitive with their pricing. And it's funny because you'll see them and they'll have big old racks. Hard drives, a big glass shelf covered with 20 hard drives. And I always get a little uptight because depending on who's behind the counter, some guys are really serious and they get out the classic tape gun and they double wrap your drive and then do an X to hold the bubble wrap in place. And some guys will do like a single wrap and fold the other edges over and throw one piece of Scotch tape on it and drop it in your bag gently, usually. But it's kind of you can get burnt with OEM packaged drives just coming from your local retail store if you're not careful. Obviously, you can spot it there.
I will say the retail stuff is usually so much more expensive. Right. You can almost buy one spare OEM, and you're just covered. You're just like for that cost, right? You're just like, well, I had one DOA. Luckily, I for the same price, I bought an extra.
Well, it's habit. Feel free to email me with hate and anger, but there are advantages to buying from somebody like Amazon or Newegg, where they are a huge company and they have very, very established procedures and they do things this way because this way works. And this way works because it minimizes the amount of cost they have to eat on dead product they ship to you. And the truth is most smaller shops are pretty good about stuff too. And as always, go ahead.
And at the end of the day, it's a mechanical device.
Right.
It's one of the few left. Right. But it's a mechanical device. It's a spinning rust. It's spinning rust that you tried to make as close to a nanotechnology level as they possibly could, right?
And so, they're doing a pretty good job.
But I've seen DOAs on retail boxed units. Mm-hmm. So I bought eight. Here's another example. I bought eight Western Digital Reds from Newegg. They were all packaged very, very well. Mm-hmm. They all worked. And then, like, 1 week into it, one of the Reds just decided to die. So, you know, I just RMA'd it through Western Digital and just got it done. But, I mean, it happens, right? It's not, it doesn't matter how good they are. It still happens.
So, one last thing before we go for Canadian Geek and Justin S. Black and anybody else out there who's thinking about buying their fabulous, exciting new Drobo NAS large storage device, QNAP, whatever it's worth, whatever they're doing. Populated with reds, populated with greens, or you know, does it just throw, if it'll support it, throw whatever you have inside of it?
Okay, if it is a flat RAID type device, mm-hmm. in other words, the QNAP stuff, or maybe even the Synology stuff, depending on how you format it, mm-hmm. reds.
Okay.
You want reds because reds have the time-limited error recovery stuff. So if you have an error with one of the other drives during a rebuild after you had one fail, it's not going to take the whole array down to, you know, with another drive failing in the middle of it. However, Drobos are very intelligent when it comes to this. They treat them more as individual drives. If another one times out, it handles it much more gracefully. So all of my Drobos, and I plural, all of my they have greens in them.
Okay.
I don't have reds in them because they just don't need to be reds. My internal RAID in my PC is, of course, reds.
Got it.
Yep.
And we should point out, for anybody who's not familiar, Western Digital categorizes its drives. Red further for storage devices, for NASs. Greens are the low power you might put in your, you know, your bigger storage or your home theater PC where you have a whole lot of video, but or yep. something that doesn't need a whole lot of performance. Then blacks are the performance drives that we would hope.
I will little bit of caveat to that though. If you find reds for just a couple of dollars more than the greens, just go ahead and get the reds.
Really?
Sometimes they're just that, you know, they're basically almost the same cost, depending. So yeah, if you're going to have them in any kind of a raid, including a Drobo, you know, if you're talking $1 or $2 per drive, right? Because the Reds have more of a an improved warranty kind of deal that Western Digital does. They have like 24/7 call service and all sorts of other bells and whistles.
It's a good thing. Does Seagate or Hitachi have anything comparable to the Red series of drives from Western Digital?
The Red is sort of like its own little beast. They're coming out with them, and they have, you know, I think each one of them now has a drive that they say has an equivalent of TLER, mm-hmm. which would make it sort of like a Red-ish sort of a drive. But usually what they do is they just reduce the price on their enterprise offering, which does have time-limited error recovery, and they just sort of say, okay, here you go. We'll just make it a consumer thing, and you get the ones that didn't pass the enterprise QA. Mm-hmm. So here, we'll just sell these to consumer because, you know, yeah.
For them. Anything you can talk about coming up on PCPer that's not under NDA? Is it safe to buy SSDs right now, or are you, you know, is it one of those, do we have anything we should be worried about or excited about coming in storage?
That you should, like, hold off? kind of stuff. Actually, exactly. Anything that comes out is, you know, there's nothing super groundbreaking that I've seen, but it's been that way for a long time, right? Once you get to the point where you're saturating whatever interface you throw at it, right? I would like to see PCI Express SSDs from Samsung, for example, since they're deciding to stick them in Macs and whatnot. I'd really like to see just a PCI Express card that just has like a, you know, the same thing that goes 800 megasecond to over a gig per second, just, you know, because all it is just, they just need to stick it in a different form factor and then you can just plug it into your PC.
So that's one of really the advantages like. of the next generation SATA that's going to come. Is it 90, the 97, the Z97 chip that's going to be offering like gigabit SATA? Is that the next evolution in SATA?
Not that we can all this fill PCI, it. This PCI Express stuff is preempting that, though.
Oh, funny.
Right? Because that M.2, well, it's sort of an M.2-ish, whatever you want to call it, because Apple can't conform to a regular hardware spec when it comes to storage. But it's basically a PCI, you know, that's what's in the MacBooks, the new ones. Actually, Ken did that write-up, which I don't think, did we talk about? Well, we sort of talked about it. We talked about it more from an aspect of battery life. But right. At the beginning of that same piece for the MacBook Air, he did take a couple of pictures and run a couple of quick benchmarks on the... His was not the Samsung. I think it was the SanDisk iteration of it. They both make them for Apple. But yeah, you're talking 800 meg per second from a solid-state drive.
That's
from
pretty awesome.
One unit, right? Because it's basically just its own PCI Express device. It just mounts as a PCI Express SSD. So forget about serial ATA. It's just going connect the flash straight to the bus through a simple controller.
That's a good thing.
You know, and a really speedy one at that, right? 800 meg per second. That's nice.
Meanwhile, next week on Techzilla, I'll be talking about a Bluetooth radio shower head. I kid you not. A shower head with Bluetooth built in. No.
Does it pulse the water at the rate of the bass of the music?
You'll have to watch the review to find out. A shooting video of that has been highly amusing. We're going to do an update on our Windows. We did kind of a brief introduction to the Windows 8.1 preview. We're going to get more in depth with sort of our top five features and caveats in Windows 8.1. Oh my goodness. Yeah. HDTVs are coming in a big way in HD Nation, but mostly it's been really funny playing around. We had like Windows 8.1 and the Ouya on Techzilla yesterday, which is interesting to see the shipping version of Ouya, which is so much better than the developer's version or the earlier version of the software on that. They made huge leaps and gains. They need more exclusive titles, though. And it's definitely not an Xbox One or a PS4 by any stretch of the imagination. At Malvantano is the place to find Mr. Alan Malvantano on the Twitters. And, of course, he writes for PCPer.com. I'm at Patrick Norton. We're all very creative with our Twitter names here at This Week in Computer Hardware. And that's it for this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Alan, thanks so much for making the time to join us today. That was awesome, man.
No problem. Anytime, man.
And we will see you next week on Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, I should mention Twitch at twit.tv is the email address. And if you want to find more episodes of Twitch, go to twit.tv/Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, to find all of our episodes and to subscribe using your favorite podcatcher. Alan, man, thanks again so much.
Thank you.
Night, everybody.